WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stay tuned for the return of Fire Sign Theater.
This is UTV, for you, the viewer. The Howl of the Wolf movie. Presenting honest stories of working people as told by rich Hollywood stars. This morning's wacky feature, Porgy and Mudhead in High School Madness, with Dave Kasman as Porgy and Joe Bertman as Mudhead.
Every period has its comedy that captures the times. The Firesign Theater nailed the late 60s and 70s with their surrealism, absurdities, non sequiturs, paranoia, parodies of the establishment, in-jokes about hippies, and knowing allusions to literature and trash culture. They got their start on radio, then created multi-track comedies on such records as Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him, How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Not Anywhere at All, and Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. The group couldn't find a place for itself in the 80s, but now they've reunited, they've been touring, and they have a new best-of collection called Shoes for Industry. In a moment, we'll meet three of the four members, David Osman, Peter Bergman, and Phil Proctor. First, we return you to High School Madness.
Oh, bombs away, Dad. Morning, Mom.
Morning, sir.
Oh, hot dog, groat cakes again. Heavy on the 30 weight, Mom.
Don't eat with your hands, son. Use your entrenching tool.
Oh, gee, Dad, I'm just trying to save time. It isn't every day a guy graduates from high school.
How many times have I heard that before?
Well, you boys fight it out among yourselves.
Okay, Mother.
Look at the time. I've got to dress for my bridge club.
Gee, Mom, isn't that bridge built yet?
No, son. And it won't be until free hands on both sides of the big ditch can press the same button at the same time.
Okay, Dad, I give. Oh, boy, can I eat my breakfast now?
Only if you stay out of trouble, boy. Your shenanigans could cost me this election.
Let's start by going around the room, and I'll ask of each of you to say your names and do at least one of the voices that we'll recognize you by.
Well, you just heard David Osman doing, can I do it?
Porgy Tire Biter. I do it in the show, but it's hard to get there anymore because now I'm about 40 years older than this character is really supposed to be.
And the other one, I guess, that's really well known is, the old man is he's either Dan Catherwood, the famous butler from Nick Danger, or the elderly George Tirebiter, who has a slightly different voice. Young and old, that's me, same time.
Well, I'm Peter Bergman, and in Dwarf, well, I play Mudhead, you know, gee, Porge. I didn't know you masturbated.
Golly,
that's my line. And on the other hand, in Nick Danger, I'm the tough Lieutenant Bradshaw. Shut up, Danger. That's how you'll recognize me.
Well, my name's Phil Proctor, and...
Hiya, friends. Ralph Sparsport, Ralph Sparsport Motors. Hello, Mr. Danger, you stupid fool. Oh, Nick, you're such a tool. Good morning, fellow kids. This is Principal Poop, etc., etc.
A man of many voices and a polyglot. He speaks many languages.
I can speak out of both sides of my mouth at the same time.
Yes. Let's do a little bit of fire sign history here. You guys got together when... You had a radio show called...
Yeah, Peter, again.
What
radio
was the show
Free
called?
Oz.
Radio Free Oz. This was on the Pacifica station in Los Angeles.
KPFK.
Listener supported.
So what kind of stuff were you doing then?
Well, this started in the summer of 1966, and FM then basically was dedicated to classical music and was not a big entertainment, pop entertainment medium at all. And I'd heard... Bob Fass's show on BAI just before I came out to California.
That's the New York Pacifica station.
He's still on BAI. And he was doing mixes of sound and all kind of, and I was very much involved in what was then the avant-garde pop culture. I'd been tangentially with the Living Theater. I'd been over in Europe. I was in a playwriting seminar with a young guy named Tom Stoppard, a young guy named Piers Paul Reed, and a young guy named Derek Marlowe, and me. There's these four 24-year-olds writing.
In Berlin.
Yeah, and that's where Stoppard wrote Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, was in this little house where we all worked. So I came back all full of the avant-garde, went out to California, started this radio show, and I was playing Indian music, and Andy Warhol was on, and the Buffalo Springfield, and all this pop culture, and astrology, and tarot, and it was a crazy late-night show, and people were going mad behind it. And in walked Phil Proctor, that I worked with in drama from Yale. He was the leading man in the musicals that I had worked with. David Osmond had just left the station as its PD and gone to put a suit on with ABC, which was not making him very happy. And Phil Austin was engineering and kind of co-producing the show. Well, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, really out of nowhere, the four of us got together. I'd been doing comedy on Radio Free Oz already. We decided to do this thing called the Oz...
Film Festival.
Film Festival Jury. And just before we went on the show that night, November 17th, 1966, I, who was an astrologer at the time, Monkey, I said, well, you're all fire signs. We're all fire signs. We're the fire sign. We're the Oz Fire Sign Theater. And we went on. And let me introduce a couple of the people that were on the show that night. On my left is a at least in his own country, a legend in his own mind, Jean-Claude, leader of the Nouvelle Vague Vague.
Yes, well, the Vague Vague, we call
and
it.
And you have a new... You have a, fond, what film are you bringing to the Oz Film Festival?
24 Hour with Georges.
Fred.
Fred. Well, yes. That's the American translation.
All right.
In French, is Georges with an S at the end. Everybody thinks it's misprinted, so we changed to Fred.
Yeah, and which, 24 Hours in the Life of Fred, is it yes. Very much that?
Une journée dans la vie de Fred.
Yeah.
Yes, it is for me being, you know, documentary filmmaker to capture reality of life, the most important thing. So I was full of my friend Fred, Georges, around the Paris, in where he lived, and film for a complete day of his life. Mm. And it's fascinating. He sleeps, we sleep. He goes to bathroom, we go to bathroom. He does nothing, we do nothing.
And how does the film end? What terminates the film?
I run out of film at the end.
I see.
So you did the radio show for quite a while, and then you ended up making the records that made you nationally famous. Mm-hmm. There was this incredible overlayering. So at the same time that you were using all these double meanings and non sequiturs and puns and stuff, there were layers and layers happening at the same time. How did you start using that kind of, for the time, very sophisticated use of audio?
It was there. It was there, and we came right from radio where there was one mic, and as you say, it was mono. Radio was entirely mono at that time. And we went into a studio, and we had four tracks, which is how many tracks the Beatles had to make Sgt. Pepper.
Means you had a piece of tape that had four channels, basically, you could record on.
And so we could continue. We would fill up two of those tracks to get stereo, and then we'd bounce it down. Ping-pong it, they call it. Mm-hmm. Down to one of the tracks, and then we'd still have three, and we'd do another one, we'd mix it and bounce it down again. And as we went along, we had every advance in the technology of recording that was available came to us as we walked into the studio, really, to do each one of our records.
That's
right. So stereo was there for us. We had our first record, Waiting for the Electrician, was released in mono as well as in stereo.
Yeah, that's right.
Those are the rare ones, the mono ones.
Wow.
And then we had 8-track, and then we went to 16-track, and the Dolbys
were
wheeled in.
Quadraphonic, when it came in. A couple of albums were done. 8-track quadraphonic. Somebody sent me one of those.
One thing to notice, though, is that we actually took advantage of what was there. It was our nature.
It was our playroom.
To use this, I had made a record as high school. I released a record in high school, which I made on my Webcore, which I'd cut. And so that, therefore, the idea of having more tracks and being able to use, because we're all theater types, more voices, was natural to the agreement of the group. I mean, we could have gone in there and just done stand-up routines or just done theater routines that were completely linear. But we didn't think in a linear way.
There were too many of us.
My guests are David Osmond, Phil Proctor, and Peter Bergman of the Firesign Theater. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are three of the four members of Firesign Theater, David Osmond, Phil Proctor, and Peter Bergman. And Phil Austin isn't with us today, but the four Firesigns have reunited for a tour. And there's also a reissue of some of their best stuff called The Best of Firesign Theater, now on CD.
Shoes for Industry.
Oh, yeah, that's the title's called Shoes for Industry.
Shoes for the Dead.
Shoes for Industry.
let's talk about Nick Danger. This is one of the This is one of the pieces that you're best known for.
They always want to talk about Nick Danger.
Shut up, Rococo.
Talk about me. Leave me alone, Bradshaw. You're an idiot.
Sorry, there's no controlling him.
This is Nick Danger, Third Eye, your private eye parody. Why don't I just play a little bit of it first?
Los Angeles. He walks again by night. Out of the fog, into the smog. Relentlessly. Ruthlessly.
I wonder where Ruth is.
Doggedly. Toward his weekly meeting with the unknown. At 4th and Drucker, he turns left. At Drucker and 4th, he turns right. He crosses MacArthur Park and walks into a great sandstone building.
Oh, my nose!
Groping for the door, he steps inside. Climbs the 13 steps to his office. He walks in. He's ready for mystery. He's ready for excitement. He's ready for anything. He's...
Nick Danger, Third Eye.
I want to order a pizza to go and no anchovies.
No anchovies? You've got the wrong man. I spell my name, Danger.
What?
The makers of fantastic cigarettes, long in the leaf and short in the can, bring you another true story from the tattered casebook of Nick Danger, Third Eye. Let's join him now in the adventure we call...
Cut him off at the past!
Let's get down to business. Uncross those beautiful stems of yours, baby. Here's the case I call number 666. It all began innocently enough on Tuesday. I was sitting in my office on that drizzly afternoon, listening to the monotonous staccato of rain on my desktop and reading my name on the glass of my office door. Regnad Kisten. My secretary lay snoring on the floor, her long, beautiful gams pinioned under the couch. I didn't hear him enter, but my nostrils flared at the smell of his perfume. Pyramid patchouli. There was only one joker in L.A. sensitive enough to wear that scent, and I had to find out who he was.
Good afternoon, Mr. Danger. I'm Rocky Rococo.
Thanks, Half Pint. You just saved me a lot of investigative work.
Maybe yes, maybe no. Do you know what this is?
I had to think for a minute. What cruel game was he playing?
That's a brown paper bag.
That's correct. Now, look inside, Mr. Danger. What do you see?
That's easy. That's a pickle.
Very good. Now, I think you're ready for this.
Why, that's nothing but a two-bit ring from a crackerback, Jocks.
I'll sell it to you for $5,000.
What kind of a chump do you take me for?
First class.
That tarnished piece of tin is worthless.
Worthless? Not to Melanie Haber.
Melanie Haber?
You may remember her as Audrey Farber.
Audrey Farber?
Susan Underhill?
Susan Underhill?
How about Betty Jo Bielowski?
Betty Jo Bielowski. I hadn't heard that name since college. Everyone knew her as Nancy. Then it all came rushing back to me like the hot kiss at the end of a wet fist. It was pig night at the Om Mani Padme Sigma house.
We had who came up with the idea of Nick Danger? Tell us how that sketch originated.
Boy, does anybody remember that? I remember where we wrote it. Yeah. We wrote it in a mansion, sort of, that you were living in Encino.
Dr. Adolph's place.
Yes. That's not where we wrote all of Nick Danger. I can
not
tell you very specifically that we wrote a lot of Nick Danger in your house on Alvarado Street. Absolutely. And I'll tell you what the impulse was to do it is that we were offered a radio show by our friend Jack Poet that we were going to do down at this big Elks Hall down in MacArthur
Downtown
Park.
LA, yeah.
And we wrote it for that, for a live radio show in this big gothic temple.
They
almost
had the biggest American flag in the United States hanging in the billiard room of that Masonic temple.
And they had
temple.
An organ and all this sort of stuff. So we wrote Nick Danger for it. It never got done there. We never did that show.
No.
That never happened. But and I don't remember that anybody thought of the idea of Nick Danger per se. Someone did, but it just happened organically out of the four of us. All of us had listened to radio detectives as youths, so nobody came in and had to explain to us what it was all about.
Because it was written for a radio show, it was It was simple, in quotes. It was a radio show.
Yeah.
And there's a photo that I recall of our recording sessions where we had four microphones. The only difference between the original broadcast, we would have been on one RCA Omni microphone. Here we were on four mics, but Phil has a walking platform, and he's doing footsteps as he's recording. We had prop door, that is a sound effects door from CBS. And we wandered all over the CBS radio buildings into the cellars and dragged out all of this old 1930s and 40s sound effect stuff, all painted battleship gray and stenciled CBS on it.
Right.
And the sound didn't sound right. There was something wrong with the way it sounded. And we said, can we please see your microphones? And they said, oh, well, yeah, sure, okay. And they opened up this big cupboard, and we said, those. And of course, they were the microphones that would have been used back in 1938, the old RCA 77 mics, ribbon microphones. And the sound was just right. It flattered the voices, the male voices, because almost all the actors on radio were male in those days.
Except maybe for Nancy.
Well, that's why we all play her, you know what I mean? And so it really is very authentic to the thing itself. It was recorded in a radio studio with the original radio mics, with the original radio sound effects. And at the time we wrote it, though, we had no idea that we were going to do it on a record. That was really an afterthought.
Yeah,
and yet it's surreal, which radio in those days, which Golden Age radio was almost completely non-surreal.
That's
true. Part of what made the work surreal was that you'd go with these kind of like long strings of puns and non sequiturs.
Mm-hmm.
And the non sequiturs were all really funny, but I was wondering how you would write non sequiturs.
Well, there are four of us.
Yeah, that's
non sequitur is our middle name. I mean, because somebody would always top the other person. Or Phil, as you've been listening for the last 10 minutes, is a little voice in the background. If there's a hole, he fills it. And so, and we also all know what we're going to say next, usually after a certain length of time, and so we can echo each other.
And anticipate each other.
There you
have it. And non-sequiturs are, we are by nature producers of non-sequiturs. I mean, I deal in them regularly. You know, live it or live with it. Now that's
shoes
that's
for industry, yeah. Shoes for the dead,
mm-hmm. And shoes for industry is something I picked up. I taught labor law, labor law, but it was part of labor history, and shoes for industry. I wrote my thesis on the Wobblies, and I found shoes for industry through studying the radical labor movement. Industrial workers of the world.
That the Wobblies had disguised themselves as women and were wearing high heels when they were picketing, so that they wouldn't be beaten up by the police. And the cops said, "Look at those guys wobbling around there." And then they went and beat the bejesus out of them, and that's why they were called Wobblies.
Thank you, Phil. Shoes for industry, and then we added shoes for the dead. I mean, shoes for the dead.
Well, it was returning dead war veterans.
But that idea of what chance does a returning deceased war veteran have for that good job? That's non-sequitur thinking. It does bring up the fact that we're sending people off with promises knowing they're going to come back in body bags, but it's still a non-sequitur.
It's also important to know that the world is made up of non-sequiturs, particularly the print world at that time.
All of politics is
all collected. I think there's a very good political example, Terry, in the politician's speech in Waiting for the Electrician, where he talks about falling over like a bridge. Mm. Does anybody remember the
That was
the
schizophrenic
lines
writing. I found that in a mad person's, well, who's to say how
You found
mad.
It on the street.
I found it on the street,
Piece
and it was
paper.
Written by an eccentric who fancied himself as a politician running for president. And it was, we must pull together as a bridge.
Like a drum.
Like a drum. It was mad writing. I have since then collected as much mad writing as I can, and, you know, it's wonderful. I understand it, of course.
If you're just joining us, my guests are three of the four members of Firesign Theater, David Ossman, Phil Proctor, Peter Bergman, and they're on tour. The group has reunited, and there's also a reissue of some of their best stuff on a CD called Shoes for Industry. When I had a radio show in Buffalo in the mid-70s, one of the things, I'd play your records all the time on the air, but one of the things I would do would be to use the commercials. Phil, would you do one of your commercials for us and tell us how you came up with it?
Oh, sure.
Hiya, friends. Ralph Sportsport. Ralph Sportsport Motors, the world's largest used, new, and new lewd automobile dealership. Ralph Sportsport Motors here in the city of emphysema. Let's just take a look at the extras on this totally used automobile. Two-way sneeze-through wind vents, edible sponge-coated steering column, star-studded mudguards, chrome fender vents, and factory air-conditioned air from our fully factory-equipped factory. It's a beautiful car, friends, with doors to match. Birch's Blacklist says this car was carjacked, but for you, friends, a complete price, only $25,500, an easy monthly pay payments of $25 a week, twice a week, and never on Sunday.
That was based on Ralph Williams. See, I came out to Los Angeles from New York. I was raised in the Midwest and basically schooled on the East Coast. And I'd never experienced the left coast, that other coast. And when I came out and saw the entirely different culture and the things that people were getting away with and the strangeness of the television culture out there, first of all, I watched a lot of television because I didn't know how to drive. I was an East Coast guy. You take a cab or a bus or a subway or you walk and sled. And I spent a lot of time watching television. I saw Ralph Williams on the television all the time. This guy had
three different channels.
He bought up television time. He was on the air all the time selling these cars and talking like that. He sounded like that. And he was a little bald, kind of chubby, gnomish looking guy. And he was selling all these cars and he'd go down a row of cars. He was like a truck, you know, with a camera on it, would go down this row of cars and he'd say, you know, $365, $275, $800. And $65. They're all beautiful cars, friends. And this rhythm, this mantra, which became, you know, like a hypnotic mantra to me. So I parodied it naturally. And since I was doing real commercials also at the same time, I was into the forms. I understood the forms of the cell. And just like all of us did with Firestone, I wanted to hook people in to think that they were listening to something real so that I could then surprise them with a political joke or a satirical joke. And that way it would also decondition them from listening to commercials and just letting it wash over them, you know, and accepting and being brainwashed by them.
Can we end with a rousing chorus of something?
How about Towed Away? Yeah, that's, you know, that's really a good ender for us, and we use it at the very end of the encore in the show.
And it is appropriate because the person who's driving us back to the hotel is parked out front in our Bozo bus.
I've heard
in
this
the
before.
Additional no parking zone, and if we don't leave right now, we will be towed away, towed away, towed away, towed away. Where do you go when you're towed away?
Thank you all. It was great fun to have you here.
Great to be
Thanks.
Here.
Thanks. Thanks, Terry.
David Osman, Peter Bergman, and Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater. Their new Best of reissue is called Shoes for Industry. The Firesign Theater is on tour. They'll be in San Francisco on November 20th and Los Angeles November 21st. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.